The Israeli spies said that the land was full of giants. It was well fortified, couldn't be invaded. They called themselves grasshoppers. What they didn't realize is they had giants in their midst. Giants like Miriam and Aaron and Moses. But they just saw them as kind of weak role models and most of the time ignored them or didn't follow them. The Israelis came down defeated from the verge of the promised land and headed back to Kadesh, where they would spend most of the next 38 and a half years of God's judgment. It's interesting to realize that the Bible compresses these 38 and a half years into 5.5 chapters. That's it. And the single year at Mount Sinai is more than 50 chapters. But what this does is it shows that these years accomplish nothing except the death of an entire generation. The generation that had left Egypt and failed to enter Canaan because of unbelief. They were years of just surviving day by day, wasted years, waiting for the old folks to die. During those years, there was a lot of movement, but little progress. And I thought, wow, that sounds like an epitaph for my tombstone. A lot of movement, little progress. It just seems to just, some days you don't get very far. And then all of a sudden you're celebrating another birthday and you're still in the wilderness. You might remember that, you know, Exodus 12 through 18 dealt with the Exodus from after the plagues to Mount Sinai. From Exodus 19 all the way to Numbers 10, what happened at Mount Sinai. Then Numbers 10 through 14, their approach and failure to enter the promised land. And now the wandering from chapter 15 to verse halfway through this chapter 20 of our text today. And then finally, from Numbers 20 to Joshua chapter 2 will be the final stage as they march on to the promised land. So our two-point outline for today's message, the two summary points, are blatantly borrowed from the wartime British Prime Minister Winston Churchill. You might remember that Churchill refused neutrality or appeasement to Adolf Hitler in 1939, and within months, Britain found itself pretty much alone. The Battle of France was over, the conquest of the continent had happened, and the Battle of Britain had just begun. In June 1940, the British Army was miraculously saved at Dunkirk. But then the aerial war began, and for 12 months, including the nighttime incendiary bombing called the Blitz, for 12 months, Britain and its population were under horrible attack, fearing every day for their lives. But in the summer of 1941, because of the heroic deeds of the Royal Air Force that fought against the planes coming over to bomb, the nation that had been outgunned and outfought and had lost every battle had a little bit of hope. Winston Churchill at that time said that never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few, thanking those who fought. But over that year, the British Army in North Africa was driven from one end to the other till they were on the outskirts of Cairo, ready to have another Dunkirk if they couldn't stop the enemy at the Suez Canal. Finally, in November of 1942, after this long series of defeats, Bernard Montgomery led the British Army to a great victory at El Alamein. It stopped the Germans and started to push them back across North Africa. The era of defeat, the beginning era of a war, was about over. The future battles against the Nazis would be more on an equal term, the middle of the war. And then eventually the victories would start outnumbering defeats, and there would be the end of the war. Hence the famous quotation that begins our sermon today, found there on the top of your bulletin. Churchill said, "This is not the end," after this great victory in North Africa. He said, "It's not even the beginning of the end, but it is perhaps the end of the beginning." The people took great hope from that. There was a joy to realize, okay, we've fought, we've lost, we've had these difficult times, but now we're moving ahead. We're going to fight some more battles. We might win some, might lose some, but eventually we're going to win. It's the same thing with Israel. That's why I set it up this way, because in Numbers 20, the first half of the chapter, verses 1 to 13, is the end of the beginning, and then the beginning of the end, as the journey to conquer the promised land begins. So, in Numbers chapter 20, yeah, you can tell I'm a history teacher. I love that kind of thing because it's real life. It's where we all live. Numbers chapter 20, verse 1, the people of Israel, the whole congregation, came to the wilderness of Zin in the first month, and the people stayed in Kadesh. Zin was the first rugged, poor land south of the promised land, and it was there that at Kadesh that the spies had been sent in. It was there that they came and decided they couldn't conquer the land, and the people whined. They said, "We'll elect somebody else to go and take us back on an exodus to Egypt." And it was a site where God brought judgment upon the people and said, "You're going to wander." Folks, this is the next to the last day of these 38 and a half years. Okay? They're at Kadesh. They're ready to say, okay, we've fulfilled this time. The generation has died out. There's just a few old timers still alive from that rebellious, unbelieving group. One was named Miriam. Verse 1 said, Miriam died there and was buried there. So one of Moses' siblings, his older sister Miriam, and by the way, don't you remember Miriam for the good thing she did? The little girl watching her baby brother in the basket in the Nile, and then when the princess took the baby out, she rushed up and said, "Oh, I have a Hebrew woman who had given birth and can nurse the baby." Happy, you know, and for years Moses was able to stay and be trained by his mother and father and in the safety of his home because of Miriam. I like her. When they crossed the Red Sea, Moses led the people, Exodus 15, led the whole nation in praise to the Lord. "Sing unto the Lord, for the horse and rider he's thrown into the sea, and the great victory." And then at the end of that, it says, "And Miriam took the women, made timbrels and tambourines, and led them dancing ahead." I like that. Now, don't necessarily do that in the church service today. I think everything should be done decently and in order, and dancing and tambourines jumping around the service might not quite be appropriate for us. But she was part of this unbelieving lost generation. Oh yeah, you say, well, wait a minute. Wasn't Miriam the one who rebelled against Moses in Numbers chapter 12, who complained about his black wife that he had married, and that they shouldn't follow him, that they, you know, all of them had the spirit, they should, you know, she should be a preacher too? And God struck her with what?
Leprosy.
And she was disqualified then from being a leader. But Miriam, you know, in my generation, born in the post-war generation, if you had a baby girl, you name that baby girl Kathy or Linda or Mary or Susan. You know, there were names that they just, that's what they did. If you had a baby boy, of course, you named him, first of all, Bob, thank you very much, Robert, or Tom, Dick, or Harry, or, you know, for real, you know, that was what, then William and so forth, those were the common names. Miriam is the most common name for a Hebrew woman at the time of Christ. She's looked back on 1,400 years earlier, and people said, oh yeah, Mary, we'd say in English, or Marianne, or Maria, depending on what language you're at, but it's all the same name. The most common name. By the way, at the time Jesus was born, the most common names for baby boys were James and John, but the most common was Joshua. It's translated in the Greek, Jesus, because that was his name. He was named Yahshua, the Savior, the Deliverer one. So Moses' sister dies, and it's an important demonstration of the fulfillment that God said every single one of the unbelievers except Joshua and Caleb are going to die. And here they're coming right up to the end. They're back at Kadesh. They had traveled around in Paran. They'd gone down to the Red Sea. They'd been all over this area for 38 and a half years, and now they're back where it all began. And God's word is fulfilled. No special exception for the family of Moses. God doesn't give exceptions. It's appointed unto men once to die. That's God's rule. People like to say, well, yeah, but if you do good things or you have good karma, Grandpa God up in heaven on his rocking chair with a big white beard, you know, he'll just kind of wink and let everybody... That's not what God says. You sin, there's going to come judgment. It's appointed unto man once to die, and after that, the judgment. So, you now, Miriam dies, the people head on out from Kadesh, and the next day they're over here towards Mount Hor, out on the edge of the border with Edom, and the people here, now think about it. How many are left in the old generation? You got Moses and you got Aaron. And that's about it. And Joshua and Caleb. The two that are going to make it. Look at verse 2. Now there were no water for the congregation. They assembled themselves against Moses and against Aaron. The people quarreled with Moses and said, "Would that we had perished when our brothers perished before the Lord. Why have you brought this assembly of the Lord into the wilderness that we should die here? Not only us, but our cattle." Because that's more important. It doesn't say our children, it says our cows. "And why have you made us come up out of Egypt to bring us to an evil place? There's no place for grain or figs or vines or pomegranate. There's not even water to drink." The need was real. They didn't have any water. Better to have died with the whole generation that they had just buried over 38 and a half years. There were no fields. Remember, God had promised that they'd walk into a land, there'd be houses, there'd be fields, there'd be vineyards, everything would be there. He said, we're out here in the middle of nowhere. And the generation of unbelief was down to two people, Moses and his brother Aaron. This is it. This is the end of the 38 and a half years. But they had obviously, that older generation had doubled down their unbelief on the new generation. They had taught the younger generation. See, that's a scary thing. Children learn some by what they hear, a little more by what they're taught, but they learn mostly by what they see. And they learn from mom and dad. And you say, well, they should have learned that if you sin, you're going to die because they buried mom and dad. That's right. That should be pretty simple. the reality is not that the children had been taught unbelief, and here they are doing exactly the same thing again. So verse 6, Moses and Aaron went from the presence of the assembly to the entrance of the tent of meeting and fell on their faces. They prayed. The glory of the Lord appeared to them. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, mark it down. Take your staff, assemble the congregation, bring Aaron your brother, speak to the rock, and tell it to yield water. And water will come out of the rock. Now, does that seem pretty simple? Pretty straightforward. Moses has been doing this for 40 years. He'd seen it happen. He knew that the new generation was just as unbelieving, just as grumbling and griping and critical as their parents had been. So God says, I'm going to repeat what I did back in Exodus 17. Remember at Rephidim where God said to Moses, take a staff and whack the rock and the rock will split open and there'll be a whole stream enough to give water for everybody. This time he says, well, you heard what he said. Just take it. Take the rod as your symbol of authority. Take your brother. Get the people. Speak to the rock and I'll give them the water. And Moses could teach a new generation this truth about God who provides. Sadly, the difficulty comes because Moses doesn't quite obey exactly what God says. Verse 9. So, he did well. Moses took the staff from before the Lord, just as the God commanded him. He and Aaron, he got his brother, gathered the people together, got all the people, and stood before the rock, and then said to the rock, oh, wait, that's not what happened. He said to the people, listen up, you rebels. Shall we bring water for you out of this rock? And Moses raised his hand and struck the rock with the staff. Nothing happened. He struck it again, and water came out abundantly, and the congregation drank, and their children, excuse me, not their children, their cows. And so the generation got the water that they needed. Moses started out doing exactly what God told him to do to a point. And then he, the same as all these other generation that had died over the last 38 and a half years, he didn't obey God. He didn't believe God. He said, I know what to do. I'm going to whack that rock like I did before. I'm going to yell at these people. I'm going to remind them that they are the problem, and if they don't take it cool, I'm going to kill them all. He said, we're going to do this because it's me and God, 50-50. We're going to get this water for him. He had a heart of bitterness. You know, prior times when the people complained, he fell on his face and prayed. He cried to God in Numbers 16. In Exodus 15, he cried out to the Lord. Even in Exodus 17, when he confronted the sin, he brought it before God and said, what do I do? This time, he let his own anger get in the way. I very seldom get angry. It's just not in my nature. I get upset. I get frustrated a lot. But anger, I kind of keep that under control. And I don't cuss. Even when I'm golfing, you know, I keep it all. You know, where I spit, the grass dies. But it's, it's they're tough. But think about Moses. Just his flesh all of a sudden took control. Here he is, two survivors left, ready to go into the promised land. But you remember what Moses did back when he was 40 years old and he learned of his Jewish heritage and he saw the Jews being mistreated? Stephen, in his sermon in Acts 7, verse 23, says that seeing one of his brothers being wronged, he defended the oppressed man and avenged him for being beaten by killing the Egyptian. He had a vengeful anger streak. You say, well, that was just one time. Oh, what about when God said, go to Pharaoh and tell him what's going to happen, and Pharaoh repented, and then another plague came, and then Pharaoh repented, and then went back on his word. You know how this story, remember going through the plagues? Between the 9th and 10th plague, we read in Exodus 11, that in verse 8, that Moses went out in hot rage. He was furious anger, rage-filled anger. And we all know what happened in the 10th plague, the death of the firstborn. When he came down out of the mountain with the 10 commandments that were actually carved on the front and back of a sheet of rock, of slate, with the finger of God, Moses didn't have to do anything. He's holding this in his hand. And he comes down from the mountain and he sees the people worshiping the golden calf. And you all remember the story there? You say, yeah, it was like about 10 years ago when you were preaching on that. It's not been that long. But what did he do? Oh, it says in Exodus 32, verses 15, 16, and 19, when he turned around with the two tablets of stone, when he came near the camp and saw the calf and saw the people dancing, Moses' anger burned hot. A vengeful anger, furious anger, burning anger. And he threw down the tablets out of his hand and broke them at the foot. And the psalmist says in Psalm 106 that they angered him here. The psalmist said they angered him at the waters of Meribah. And it went ill with Moses on their account because they made his spirit bitter. And he spoke rashly with his lips. Bitter anger, vengeful anger, furious anger, burning anger. This is a whole sermon I think we could preach there on how not what happens when you get angry. Because Moses is an angry man. And he's upset with the people and he's upset with the Lord. He doesn't do what God told him to do. He says, I'm going to work this out. The people needed water. And by the way, the people needed the water and God is merciful. God used the failure of Moses. He failed here. He's as unbelieving as any of the generation. And God used that as a way to still give water to his people. And so that his love was so great that... Excuse me here. His love was so great for the people that even though man was imperfect, God's love was there for them and gave them the water. But you can see what's going to happen to Moses, can't you? Because God's going to have to judge him. Not that he shouldn't have been judged 3 or 4 times before for his anger and all these different things, but this is it. He just identified himself 100% with the same generation that had just died and was buried out in the wilderness. Numbers 20, verses 12 and 13, the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you didn't believe me, you didn't uphold me as holy in the eyes of the people of Israel, therefore you will not bring this assembly into the land I've given them. These are the waters of Meribah, where the people of Israel quarreled with the Lord, and through them he still showed himself as holy. What Moses did was unholy. He made God look no different than the pagan deities, than the idols, than the temperamental gods that were angry with men. He didn't show the love of God. He didn't show that this is the God that we love. The rock was struck once. Now all you do is speak to it, and it'll give water. Someone said, any worship of God is good. You can't worship God the wrong way. And I wanted to pull Dr. Phil on him and say, how's that working out for you, Cain? Because we can worship God the wrong way. And God will judge it. Moses fulfilled the urgent need of the people. Give them water. Okay, that got rid of the griping. But he didn't show God as holy. He didn't show God as the one in control and sovereign. He didn't communicate. Instead, he raged in sin and anger, and it had consequences because justice would be served. The generation that died in the wilderness had died because they did not believe God and obey him. And Moses is under the same penalty. Everyone might have thought Moses is the one that would be exempt. If God's going to make an exception, he'll do it for Moses. He'll make it there, but you know, Moses was judged not for one sin. It was obviously, as we've seen, his whole life. But he was also judged because of his position as a leader. Did you know that your pastor will receive greater judgment than you will? If I don't proclaim to you the Word of God, if I kind of pussyfoot around and sip iced tea and lemonade and don't say what God's Word is saying here, God will hold me accountable. James in chapter 3, verse 1 says, "Brothers, not many of you should be teachers, because those who teach will be judged with a stricter standard." God holds the preacher up as a leader. He's holding Moses up, saying, "Hey, Moses," and by the way, Aaron was with him, saying, "Moses and Aaron, you know, you're the leaders. Everybody looks up to you. If you sin and get by with it, what's that going to teach this new generation? That I'm holy? No. That I'm a loving God who's going to care? No. They'll just say, hey, I can get by with sin too." And so there's a holy fear. Someone asked me the other day if I was ready to retire, if I'm ready to quit. They said, "You got a birthday coming up, right?" And I said, "Oh yeah, I live that long. I'll be 70. They said, "Well, boy, that's really old." And I said, "Thank you very much. That's encouraging to have people tell me things that I don't understand or don't realize." And they said, "Well, you ought to just retire. Do you really enjoy what you're doing?" And I got that childish, sheepish smile on my face. And I said, "Yeah, I really like it. I really love it. I love to spend time in the Word. I love to teach it. I love to see light come on and love to see people go, that was really good. That really touched my heart. I love that." Moses was judged to a higher standard. And then let's not forget that the rock wasn't just a rock. In 1 Corinthians 10, the Apostle Paul uses it as an illustration of that generation and says that in verse 4, they drank from a spiritual rock that followed them. The rock was Christ. No simile or metaphor. The rock was like Christ. It was as Christ. Christ was the rock. When they came up to this rock, it looked like a rock, but it was really God. And at Rephidim, it had been struck once and gave out its life-giving water. It doesn't need to be struck again, especially not twice. First Corinthians 10 continues, that with many of them, God was not well pleased. They died in the wilderness. And these things were our examples, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things like they lusted. Jesus himself will stand up one day in John chapter 7 and say, "If anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water." God is there. What a beautiful picture of Christ. Just speak, and I'll provide. And here's Moses, ruining it all. Does he die on the spot? No. but he's disqualified and he's going to die soon. Because that was the end of the beginning. As they had left Kadesh and marching over towards Edom, ready to go up and around the Dead Sea and into the Promised Land. And that's the beginning of the end. The second part of our message here, beginning in verse 14 of Numbers 20. From Kadesh, Moses sent messengers to the king of Edom. And here's the message. Thus saith your brother Israel, you know all the hardship that we've met, how our fathers went down to Egypt, we lived there a long time, the Egyptians dealt harshly with us and our family. When we cried to the Lord, he heard our voice, sent an angel, brought us out of Egypt, and here we are on the edge of your territory. Please, let us pass through your land. We'll not pass through field or vineyard or drink water from a well. We'll go along the King's Highway. We have it listed out here on the map, right up through the middle of Eden. We're going to go across. We'll get the highway and just march right up the interstate. Okay, this is Interstate 25, if you're interested. Just the main route. We're not going to go off. We'll just stay on the road. If we pass through your territory, we'll pay for anything we take. You know, remember, the Edomites, Idumean in the New Testament, I-D-U-M-E-A-N, were the close relatives with Israel. They're both descendants of the twins that Isaac had. That Rebecca had. The twins were born. Esau was the first, and his descendants were called the Edomites. They settled in the area on this side of the Rift Valley here, in this region here. And the other boy's name was Jacob, or Israel, and he and his 12 sons settled on the other side. And so he said, hey, you know, we're brothers. Brothers don't fight. Do I want to check that? I'm looking around. I'm seeing three brothers looking at me like, oh, yeah, we never have a crossword. Okay, we're not invading you. We're going to simply go through your land. We'll take care of it. But Edom said, verse 18, no, you can't pass through the land lest I come out with my army against you. The people of Israel remind him, said, we'll go by the highway. If we drink water or livestock, have grass, you know, we'll pay you for it. We're just coming on foot. No chariots, no army, nothing. We're just going to march through on foot. Just let us, you know, it's a couple 3 days. Just hit the highway and head north. We'll be in Sheridan before you know it. You know, Heshbon, excuse me, up in the north. You know, we'll head on up. But the king of Edom said, you'll not pass through. And the Edomites came out with a large army and refused to give him passage into his territory. So now you got almost, you know, you got a border war going. They aren't going to build a wall, but they're going to put an army right out there on the border and say, you can't come across. So Israel will have to turn away. This will come to play a little bit more in next week's message, because they're going to have to go around. Here's Petra, the capital of Edom. They're going to have to go from here all the way around, circle all the way out into the desert area, and not hit the King's Highway till they're up in Moab, up ahead, up north. It's going to be a mess. And guess what the people are going to do from having to go this big, long detour? What would you do if you had to go on a big, long detour? They did what they were good at. They grumbled. They griped. I remember my wife and I taking a trip, and we needed to go to the Midwest. And I said, well, I'm not going to cut across the Lusk and over the Black Hills and catch the interstate. I'm going to go on up to Midwest and Edgerton and then cut up to Gillette and take the longer on the interstate, but it's actually a faster route. We got up to Edgerton, and on the opposite side of Edgerton, as you go up the hill into the wilderness, by the way, a roadblock came down right in front of us. As we're driving, down came the gate, and I'm thinking, okay, Lord, this is May. There's not a cloud in the sky. This is not a blizzard. What happened? So we stopped, and a policeman came out and said, there's been a horrible accident. The whole road up ahead is clear, is messed up. It was dealt with an oil truck with pipes all over. You can't get around whatsoever. It'll probably be 4 or 5 hours. So being like a good child of Israel, I grumbled, I griped, and I looked at my wife and I said, well, I know what we're going to have to do. And she said, yeah, we'll have to go back down to Casper and go across the way we should have gone to begin with. You know, why do that? And I said, no, I'm going to cut up to Buffalo and go across to Gillette that way. Take the long way. And we drove like crazy and went all the way to Gillette, where we met the people who had been stopped at the roadblock because the road had opened in those 2 hours and they had gone up. And anyway, another story. Griping, complaining in there. Well, the people journeyed from Kadesh. Miriam had died. Moses had been disqualified and going to die. And now they're back up here saying, what are we going to do? We're right here at the edge on the border. We can't do it. So they came to Mount Hor, the last high ground where they could look out and see where they should be going. They came to Mount Hor. And verse 23, the Lord said to Moses and Aaron on the border of Eden, let Aaron be gathered to his people, for he shall not enter the land that I've given to the people of Israel, because you rebelled against my command at the waters of Meribah. Take Aaron and Eleazar his son, bring them up Mount Hor, strip Aaron of his garments, put them on Eleazar his son, and Aaron, the euphemism, shall be gathered to his people. He's going to die. Aaron was the final death of the rebellious generation before they began to enter the promised land, heading up around. They were marching to the end, and he was a survivor. But the promise of death that had come on that generation applied to Aaron too. In Numbers 33, it says in verse 38, Aaron died there on the day of the 40th year after the children of Israel had exited from Egypt when he was 123 years old. Isn't that amazing? God's timing is perfect. He said 40 years? Here it's 40 years. They're right on the edge. They're going to start into the promised land. They can't actually go straight because of the army in front of them. And Aaron is to die. The passing of Aaron as the high priest in the history of Israel is a landmark. He was the first one. He's the one who was in charge of the tabernacle and all the sacrifices and everything. His sons had rebelled. They'd been killed. But one son was still there. And the Lord said, okay, after a lapse of time and much suffering, your journey's now going to recommence. You're going to head into the promised land. But Moses can't lead you there, representing the law, can't do it. Miriam, the prophet, can't lead you to the promised land. Aaron, the priest, can't lead you to the promised land. It's going to take a new man, Joshua, Jesus, to lead you there. And so with Moses and Aaron and his now surviving oldest son, Eleazar, we read the end of the chapter 20. Verse 27, Moses did as the Lord commanded, and they went up Mount Hor in the sight of everyone. And Moses stripped Aaron of his garments and put them on Eleazar his son, and Aaron died there on the top of the mountain. And Moses and Eleazar came down from the mountain, and when the people saw that Aaron had perished, they wept for 30 days. I think this would be the longest walk in history. Moses and his brother They'd work together. Remember, you know, Moses, I can't speak. I'll need to do some help to be the God's person. Aaron's right there. And through the whole thing, Aaron's right there. He was his partner, his mouthpiece. He'd established the priesthood. He was a prayer warrior every time there was a problem. Oh, yeah, he also carved the golden calf and challenged Moses' authority with Miriam and that. Okay, he wasn't perfect. We know that. But his office was worthy of respect. This is the man. This is the leader. And can you see all of Israel, tens of thousands of people standing there and watching them? Mount Hor is not a big, steep, rugged, rocky mountain type thing. It's only about 1,500 feet above the level of the plain around it, and there's no trees on it. And everyone could see those two brothers. And I want to think that they probably went up hand in hand. It may be on the other side of Aaron, his son. And the great generation is dying. The generation of unbelief. The first priest. Now, we know in Hebrews that we have a high priest greater than that. We have the Lord. That's wonderful truth. You can study yourself in verses 14 to 16 of Hebrews 4, that we can receive mercy and grace in the time of our need. But what a poignant way to end this chapter. As I prepared this message, I found myself more than once with tears in my eyes. You say, well, you're not quite as old as Moses, who's 120. Or Aaron, who's 123, or Moses, who's 126, or excuse me, Miriam, 126. But a story of real life, real pathos, real obedience and real disobedience, and a real God who says, okay, your time is up. In one chapter, the three leaders, that's it. Reminding us that the wages of sin is still death. Douglas MacArthur, a hero of mine, who also had a lot of foibles, said that old soldiers never die, they just fade away. When I was a boy in Minnesota, I fell in love with the Civil War. I couldn't believe how important that was in the history of our nation. You say, wait a minute, the Korean War had just ended. Nah, not important. World War II had just ended when you were born. Yep, not as important. But the Civil War, I saw old people, I mean old guys, wearing tattered gray and blue uniforms and a kepi. They had big, I called them gray beards, because they'd have big beards. And they were old. They were probably 70. They were old. They literally were 100 veterans of the Civil War. And I read everything I could there living in Minnesota. And in a nearby town of Windom, Minnesota, there was a Army hospital that had been set up during the war. And there was a fellow by the name of Willard Woolson who fought at Shiloh and was wounded. And he was transported back to the hospital to recuperate. Well, he didn't recuperate. He died there in Windom, Minnesota. But his wife came and his son came to see him there. And when he died, his son, Albert, at age 14, lied about his birth and entered the Union Army as a drummer boy for 1st Minnesota Company C of the Heavy Artillery Regiment. And he went off to fight in his father's place. I could hardly believe. Folks, when I was young, that guy was still alive, living just near our house. A veteran of the Civil War. Well, a drummer boy, he never shot a rifle in the whole thing, but still just amazing to me. Because after the war was over, he returned to Minnesota and worked in veterans' benefits and helped in the Grand Army of the Republic, a kind of a fraternal order that all the veterans could join. And he was the last one to die of that entire generation. And I remember like it were yesterday. I can't remember yesterday, but I can remember something like it was yesterday. President Eisenhower said that the people have lost their last personal link to that great war. His passing brings sorrow to the heart of all who cherish the memory of the brave men and women of that era. That impacted me. I left that time, and that was back in, I think, 1958 when he passed. Just as a kid, vowing that I want to be a soldier. I want to go fight. That's when I got my first blue uniform to start reenacting the Civil War battles so that by 1963 I could go to the 100th anniversary of Gettysburg. I wanted that. Why? There was a link between me and the generation that had passed. And Miriam and Aaron. And in a few weeks after they loop around and head on up to the Promised Land, Moses, the last links will be passed. You see, we entitled our message today, The Frailty of Giants. Because even giants die. R.C. Sproul, a giant spiritual leader of our generation, just passed a couple of weeks ago. We die. The workmen die, but the work continues. The lessons are there not to be unbelieving, not to doubt God, not to twist what his promises are, not to say, well, okay, I'll get my staff, I'll gather the people, I'll take Aaron, I'll go to the rock, and then I'll do my own thing. See, that's religion today. And God says that'll bring judgment. I want to be linked to the giants of the past, of obeying and following the Lord. I hope that's a desire of your heart, too, as we ponder Numbers 20 again.